The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Shell, and today's episode deals with the rarest of rare species, and whether we should be worried about them or not. Later on, we'll speak to Stuart Pym, who makes the case against bringing extinct species back to life. But let's begin by talking about some animals that are very nearly the last of their kind. My guest is Eric Dinnerstein, lead scientist and vice president for conservation science at the World Wildlife Fund. His areas of specialty include tropical mammals, large mammal biology, biogeography, bats, rhinos, seed dispersal, and community ecology. He's the author of The Kingdom of Rarities. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
How long have you been researching rare animals exactly?
It probably began when I was a graduate student, and I had the chance to follow or try to find the northern spotted owl on the slopes of Mount Baker in the state of Washington. And this is a very rare species. It's a bird that only lives in old-growth forest, and only even in particular old-growth forest. It likes open canopies where it can understories, where it can hunt its favorite species, which is flying squirrels. And because old-growth forest is so limited, it's become quite rare. And on top of that, because it's a predator, it's never very numerous. So I suppose it's one of those iconic animals that in many ways, like owls often are, that highlights some of the important themes of rarity that I only really rediscovered when I started thinking about writing this book.
And how old were you?
Oh, I was probably in my 20s there, but to be quite honest, I was a real late bloomer as a biologist. You know, I often think of myself as a poster child to reassure parents who are terribly concerned about what their kids want to do or don't want to do when they're undergraduates. I didn't become a biologist probably until I was 22. I think that, you know, it just takes a while before the light bulb goes off. And once I was on the right track, I realized that and I never looked back. But so I think I'm a good testament for parents just to stop worrying and let their kids follow their own path.
And so what do we mean when we say that an animal is rare?
Typically, when biologists talk about rarity in regards to a species, they say an animal is rare if it either has a very narrow range or it occurs at very low densities over large areas, like, let's say, a tiger or a jaguar or a wolf or a grizzly bear. All of those species, because they're top predators, occur at low densities. Or species can be both. It can have a very narrow range and have a very low population density, like some of the characters in my book, like, for example, the mystically named golden-mantled tree kangaroo of New Guinea.
But it does seem like rarity is actually the standard. It's uncommon for a species to be common. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's one of the most poorly known facts about biology. In fact, it's hardly even in a lot of textbooks. A few years ago, one of the leading authors, leading scientists on rarity, Kevin Gaston, put it very well. He put his finger on what I call the great asymmetry of life on Earth. He said that perhaps 95% of all individual organisms on Earth are comprised of only 20 to 25% of all species. So if you turn that on its head, it means that the other 75% are mostly rare. So in fact, rarity is really common. It's unusual for species, that many species, to be widespread and common. And you can go almost anywhere in the tropics and you find the same pattern over and over. A few really super abundant species and lots of species represented by only a few individuals.
Well, then that would mean that not every rare species is on the verge of extinction then.
That's correct. In fact, I opened the book, the first chapter takes place on the island of New Guinea. And I chose that location because a colleague of mine, Bruce Beeler, who's a world expert on birds of paradise and bowerbirds and wrote The Birds of New Guinea, found a place that he'd been trying to get into for 25 years that the red tape of the government had resisted his access. he finally got permission of the government and the locals who live in this area, and it was a place that no human being had ever set foot in before. It took a helicopter ride up a very steep mountain and dropped down into essentially a bog in order to access this place that would have been a two-week walk from the nearest village. And what he found there was very interesting, because even in a place where humans had never set foot, hunters, miners, anybody, that the same patterns that we see in other tropical forests were present in the Foja Mountains of New Guinea, in that many species were rare, naturally rare.
Well, then, so maybe the question is, why are there so many rare species and so few common ones?
That is the fundamental question of community ecology, of how species interact in nature. And there are a bunch of reasons for that, and my book explores a number of them. I often say that rarities like beauty and intelligence, it can take many forms. And so part of the book and part of the appeal for writing it for me was learning about and trying to explain these different forms of rarity, these different causes for it.
Well, then, why do you and other scientists study rarity?
That's a very good question. You know, it's interesting that a lot of the examples that we find in our textbooks or that we talk about today, or most of what we even know about the science of ecology, it comes from studying widespread and common species. And in fact, most species are neither. And so my book, if you will, is sort of an antidote to that view of life on Earth. And it celebrates the rarities, everything from rhinoceroses to golden mantle tree kangaroos to giant anteaters to bald-faced saki monkeys to jaguars to species of antelope like the salwa, the most recently discovered large mammal on Earth in the forests of Vietnam and Laos. And these species have a lot to tell us, both of how the world once was and how it might be and which species are likely to continue to survive as climate changes and land use changes. And the world that they evolved in is actually quite different from the world that we see today or the world that we'll see in the future.
Now, you just earlier made a distinction between rarity of species and rarity of particular populations. So then, are the most rare species the ones that are only found in one population on one site?
That's right. A few years ago, the most famous conservation biologist of our time, E.O. Wilson of Harvard, came out with a calculation to illustrate the severity of the extinction problem we face. In fact, almost all scientists agree, that we are in the sixth great extinction spasm in the history of our planet. The difference is that the first five happened before human beings appeared. So this one has our fingerprints all over it. And Ed calculated that as many as 100 species are going extinct every day. Now, this calculation is based on extrapolation of species that live in the tropics and how fast deforestation is occurring and how narrow their ranges are. And so it takes about a paragraph or two to explain how this was calculated, but most scientists ascribe to it. However, some cynics said, okay, Dr. Wilson, 100 species a day are going extinct, and so you say, name them. Well, it's a difficult thing to do, but a group of scientists and I got together, scientists who span a number of different conservation NGOs, and we asked that question, who are the next dodos? Can we be predictive and figure out which are the species that are most likely looking at the precipice of extinction? And we came up with a couple of conditions that define those species that are perched on the brink. And one of those is to have your entire population limited to a single site. And the other is that your population or the species has been evaluated by the IUCN and been put on the red list of critically endangered or endangered species. And so meeting those two criteria of being critically endangered and having only one place on Earth that you live puts you right on that edge. So plow that site, burn it, flood it, pave it, and it's gone forever. And so we came up with a study that looked at all the birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians on Earth that met those criteria and found to our surprise that it only was a list of about 900 species, found it at about 600 sites. So several species can be found at a given site. And that was a lot better than we thought. We thought there'd be many more. Also, we found that half of those sites are protected, but the other half are not. So one could say that if we wanted to avoid extinctions and we cared about conserving rarities, then those 300 sites that lack any kind of protection, that would be ground zero for preventing any more extinction.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Eric Dinnerstein, the author of The Kingdom of Rarities. Now, are there certain locations where you are more likely to find rarities?
Absolutely. In fact, the hotbeds of rarities are on tropical mountains. So there are mountains scattered around the tropical belt that are teeming with rarities. We can think of Mount Kinabalu on the island of Borneo. It's the highest peak between the mountains of New Guinea and the Himalayas. And this mountain has probably more species on it that occur only there than anywhere else on Earth. So, for example, there are about 75 species of orchids that are only found on Mount Kinabalu. There are a number of pitcher plants, those insect-eating plants, that are only found there. The genus ficus, that are the figs, there are probably 850 species of figs in the world, and about 75 or 85 only occur on Mount Kinabalu. There's even the Kinabalu rat, which sometimes hides in the pitcher plants, and that's only found on Mount Kinabalu. But we could go to Mount Kenya, Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa, or Mount Cameroon in Africa, or a mountain called the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta in Colombia that arose before the Andes, and all of these mountains are chock full of rarities. You can even go to the island of Haiti, where you have the Massif de la Haute that has 13 species of a kind of frog found nowhere else on Earth. So if you want to go looking for rarities, you go to the tops of mountains in the tropics.
So why is that? What kind of characteristics of a location would foster rarity?
Well, typically, rarity occurs where species have been isolated for a long period of time. So that's a critical ingredient of rarity, is that you often find them in the tropics where you have very high mountain ranges because the species might have been living on low mountains. Over time, the mountains rose up because of the geology of that area, and they became separated from other populations that were similar. So either the species were unable to disperse and reconnect, or they just had certain requirements to live in certain kinds of environments, and they stayed put. And it's the separation, but then the separation with long periods of isolation that kept these species distinct and also made them rare. So in fact, I even titled the first chapter of the book, The Gift of Isolation, because it's this gift that's given us so many rarities and so many amazing species because of that.
Now, we usually think of islands specifically as having those kind of characteristics, but there are other locations as well.
There are, but islands are a good place to start. You know, it's funny that in textbooks, we often talk about the voyage of Charles Darwin on the Beagle, and of course, how his ideas of evolution by natural selection came from, in part, his observations of a group of finches, about 14 species, that he found on the Galapagos and collected, and then years later came up with his theories. But in fact, if Darwin and Captain Fitzroy decided, you know what, let's skip the Galapagos, and they were on the coast of Chile, let's just keep sailing, let's go on to Hawaii. Instead of the Galapagos finches, we'd be reading about the Hawaiian honeycreepers instead, because they would have found, if they landed on Hawaii, 51 species of honeycreepers that underwent an even more dramatic radiation than the Galapagos finches. Now, what's interesting about Hawaii is that it's an oceanic archipelago, a group of islands, and on some islands you had certain species of honeycreepers, and on some on others. Now, honeycreepers can fly so that they could move around, but some of them indeed found specific habitats they like, and they stayed put, and so on some islands of Hawaii you had certain species and on some on others. But this is an important point, is that for things like birds that can fly around, they can island hop, but mammals are particularly bad dispersers because we're not very good swimmers and we can't drink seawater. So you get a mammal on one island, and it's more than likely, unless it gets on a raft of vegetation to get to another, it's probably not going to make it. So you find a lot of rare mammals on island, whether it's Madagascar or New Caledonia or others. And you often don't find that many. So when you get out to the South Pacific, it becomes more and more depauperative mammals. And that's because mammals just can't swim, aside from the marine mammals. The terrestrial mammals are pretty notoriously poor dispersers.
Well, maybe let's talk about some specific species. And you've actually separated the book into locations. And I need to point out that this book is very similar to a travel guide in many parts, which is lovely. But each location sort of houses a number of rarities.
That's right.
What species do we see in the Amazon rainforest?
The Amazon's really interesting because it's a different pattern of rarity. You know, the Amazon, the rainforests themselves, the rainforests of Earth, are the treasure trove of rarity. So we probably have about 50% of all species on Earth confined to no more than 5% of the land area. So think about that, the disproportionate number of rarities that's jammed into rainforests. But when you get to these really big expanses like the Amazon, it's an interesting pattern. Instead of having species that are localized to a given area, like on the top of mountains, because the Amazon is mostly lowland and flat, that the species tend to be pretty widespread across the Amazon, but they always occur, or they often occur, at very low density. So that's the other definition of rarity. So we think of jaguars as occurring at very low densities, or mountain lions, which I feature in the book, in the Peruvian Amazon. And because they're top predators, they always occur at low densities. Certain species of monkeys are the same way, but perhaps the best example are tropical rainforest trees. Now, there are a few species that are widespread and common, like Brazil nuts and a few others, but the typical pattern for most tropical trees is one individual in a given area, let's say a hectare, and then you won't find another example of that individual unless you expand your search to maybe 5 hectares. That's very different than the forest where I live in around Washington, D.C. and in Maryland, or in much of the United States and Canada, is that you have a much higher density of species in a given area. So this is a phenomenon of the tropics, and one that reaches a pinnacle in the Amazon, where on a single hectare, you can have as many as 200 different species of trees.
Why is that?
That's another great question that biologists have scratched their heads and scratched the trees and tried to figure out why that is. And perhaps the most widely accepted theory is that has to do with predation on the trees, on the leaves themselves. So one major difference between the tropics and, say, the forests in Canada or the northern U.S. is that the insects, that the creatures that defoliate the leaves, they punch out for a number of months of the year because it's winter, and they only start operating again when the weather gets warm. Whereas in the tropics, it's 24/7. You've got individual creatures, different species of all different kinds, munching on those leaves. Some eat the cuticle, some eat just the veins, some mine out the leaves, all sorts of leaf predators. And so it's thought that if any individual tree gets too common, then its leaf predators, which are specialized on that particular species, find it and defoliate it. So there's strong selection on clustering against it of individual species in certain areas. And that's why you find this distribution with only one individual here and then another individual over there and not many together in the same place.
Well, what about the rare mammals, like the jaguars, for example? How do you study them?
Well, first, just to say why they're rare, because that's a really important question. And it's probably one of the easiest to answer in terms of explaining and understanding rarity. So top predators are always rare. Whether it's jaguars in the Amazon or tigers in Asia or great white sharks, you just can't have a lot of top predators because they require a lot of prey to support a single individual. So they need big areas and they need lots of prey. Let's just skip over jaguars for a moment. We'll come back to them and just talk about tigers because we know a lot more about them. For example, we know that it takes about 52 elk-sized deer per year to fuel a breeding female tiger. Less than that, and the tigers won't be able to breed. So it simply takes a lot of deer in an area to support a single breeding pair. Now, the same is true with jaguars, that it takes a lot of peccaries, which are their favorite food, to support a breeding pair of jaguars. In fact, we reckon that a density of only 4 jaguars per, say, 100 square kilometers, that's still a relatively dense population of jaguars in the Amazon.
A topic that you kept coming back to in the book, and I think this is very relevant here, trophic cascades.
Yes.
Maybe explain what that is.
Well, that's another piece of jargon that ecologists like to use, but it's really pretty simple. And what it means is that we have these top predators in the system and or are large herbivores like elephants or rhinos, and you remove them and the system goes haywire. And let me give you 2 examples. Let's start first with the predators and the herbivores. And this one, we're not even going to go to the tropics. We're going to stay right here in the eastern United States, and I could go outside my door and see this. We have an overpopulation of white-tailed deer in the eastern U.S., and the reason is because we no longer have the top predators, the wolves and the mountain lions, that used to hunt them. Now, if we still had wolves and mountain lions moving along the Potomac River near my house and outside Washington, D.C., I can assure you that the deer would be scarce. You wouldn't be seeing them popping up in people's gardens or on their front lawns. They would be much lower in number and much more secretive in their behavior. And because the deer are so overabundant, we see dramatic changes places. For example, if you walk through a forest in the eastern U.S., there's some places where you see no regeneration at all of the forest. They're essentially what biologists call senescent forests, or forests that are dying, because all the seedlings that are palatable to the deer have been eaten out. And similarly, you also have the problem that there are many songbirds in the eastern U.S. that prefer to nest low to the ground or on the ground, and because the deer open up all that vegetation by their browsing, it means that these birds are exposed to nest predators, and so their nests fail. So just by removing the top predators, you have this effect of a cascade that goes down the food chain, or goes down the trophic levels, which is essentially the food chain, that have these dramatic effects, these unintended consequences in this system because you pulled off the top predators. So it's a dramatic effect, and we see it all over the world wherever you have large mammals on top, either as predators or as herbivores. We even see this, for example, where African and Asian elephants and rhinos are common, because we think of them as what we call landscape engineers or landscape architects. And in the book, I talk about a study I did in Nepal with the greater one-horned rhinoceros and the Asian elephant, where we excluded them from the forest, which isn't easy to do. You have to put up big stockades. But when you do that, we saw pretty clearly that the trees, the individuals of the trees that reach the canopy in those forests, are the ones that are unpalatable to rhinos and elephants as seedlings and saplings, because they bend them down and chew on them. And when we protected the forest, we saw all the palatable ones finally get a chance to reach the canopy. So in other words, a forest without its rhinos and elephants look very different than a forest that still has a full complement of these giant browsing mammals.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back to talk more with Eric Dinnerstein about his book, The Kingdom of Rarities, after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, here with Eric Dinnerstein, lead scientist and vice president for conservation science at the World Wildlife Fund, and the author of The Kingdom of Rarities. So, not all animals that are rare are extinct. We've established that. But what allows some species to adapt to things like human encroachment, natural disaster, and definitely, as is current now, climate change, and others to end up endangered?
One of my favorite lines from the book comes from one of the most perceptive ecologists of our age, Gordon Oriens, who said that natural selection has no foresight. And what he meant by that was that many of the traits, the features that we see in animals and plants around us today, they were selected for eons ago. In other words, natural selection doesn't know, is the climate going to change next year or 10 years from now or 300 years from now? It's selecting for the moment of what the species is encountering as we speak. And so, in many ways, a species' ability to adapt to a changing environment, let's say climate change or global warming, warming of the seas, acidification of the ocean, may be just a byproduct of other features that were selected for. So let me give you some examples to illustrate that. One of the chapters focuses on the Kirtland's warbler, the most endangered songbird in North America. Now, this is one fussy bird. It's the epitome of rarity. The Kirtland's warbler, there's probably only about 2,000 singing pairs in the world. They winter in the Bahamas, and they nest in only one place in North America, overwhelmingly one place, the town of Grayling, Michigan, about 5 hours north of Detroit. And they nest in 5 to 20-year-old jack pine stands. That's it. If it's less than 5 years old, more than 20, they won't nest there. But on top of that, the jack pine has to be on really sandy soil, because if it's not sandy, the Kirtland's warbler, which nests on the ground, that when it rains hard, the chicks would get soaked and the water wouldn't percolate down and they would die. But on a sandy substrate, a sandy surface, then the water goes right through and the chicks stay dry and healthy and able to fledge easier. So this is one really fussy bird, because it needs a very particular kind of forest and a very particular kind of sandy substrate on which to nest. And so these birds are an example of a highly restricted species that occurs at low density, but it has the advantage because they only like this kind of habitat, and they can fly, they can search around. for others that are like it. And that's exactly what's happening now as their preferred habitat in Grayling, Michigan starts to get filled up, what biologists call its reaches carrying capacity, then younger birds are dispersing and finding new sites upon which to nest for the future. These birds are fortunate because they can fly and they can find new places. But our biggest concern with climate change are species that are the opposite of the Kirtland's warbler that can't disperse very well. So we can imagine species like a lot of invertebrates or a lot of plants that have a very narrow range and the climate may change and they may not be able to adapt to the conditions where they used to live and they won't move fast enough to another place where the conditions might be better. And so those are the ones that we are quite concerned about.
Well, let's go back to Kirtland's warblers because that is one fascinating bird. Might there have been a point in the past when they weren't so rare?
Probably true. So the jack pine forest, which is found in a large belt across northern United States and southern Canada, has pretty wide range. And in fact, the jack pine goes all the way up to the Yukon. And it's not like the Kirtland's warblers are sissies. They're large warblers. In fact, they're the second largest warbler in North America, next to the yellow-breasted chat. And so they have a large enough body size that they could certainly contend with the Yukon. Even things like the yellow warbler and the yellow throat go all the way up to the Yukon. So why doesn't the Kirtland's warbler? And the answer seems to be it's the soil substrate issues. They need to be on sandy soil. But there probably was a period when the jack pine habitats on sandy soil was more widespread, and a combination of a change in climate where the jack pines were replaced by other species and clearing of the habitat for human activities have reduced the Kirtland's warbler to the point where it's one of those species that I talked about earlier that the Alliance for Zero Extinction helped try to identify these 600 sites in the world where species are limited to one place, and the Kirtland's warbler fits that bill. So, yes, they might have been more widespread at one point in the past during the Pleistocene, but now their range is Grayling, Michigan, at least their breeding habitat, and we have to do all that we can to save them.
So what does this tell us about rarity? Is there extreme pickiness in terms of habitat a cause of rarity, or is it a condition of it?
That's another great debate in biology. And in fact, I side with a group that looks at it as just a phenomenon, not a cause. Here's the best way to explain it. Let's look at the black-tailed prairie dog. Now, this is a creature that lives in grasslands, and it's very specialized. It only lives in grasslands. And in fact, most vertebrates, most birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, they're all specialists. One of the few animals we might call a generalist, where it can live almost anywhere, Homo sapiens. You pick almost any habitat on Earth, and you can find us there. We not only settle it, we adapt to living there, and we even change the environment to suit our needs. But most species are different than that. They are specialists. So take that black-tailed prairie dog. You'll only find it in grasslands. But because the grasslands that it preferred were so widespread across the western U.S. and Canada, the animal was really abundant and common. In contrast, you take a bird like, say, the California gnatcatcher that only lives along the southern coast of California and prefers these areas that are inundated by fog. That's a very limited piece of real estate, a very expensive one, too. That's where all the movie stars live. And that's where the California gnatcatcher makes its home, and that's why it's so endangered, because its habitat is so limited. Because it's a specialist, so is the black-tailed prairie dog, but the California gnatcatcher, like a lot of species, is specialized in a habitat that just isn't very extensive.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Eric Dinnerstein, the author of The Kingdom of Rarities. Would you characterize rhinos as being that picky about their environment, their habitat?
Well, I think that certainly the one that I studied, the greater one-horned rhinoceros, its favorite food is wild sugarcane, and that species only occurs along the banks of the rivers of South Asia. At one time, it was probably fairly abundant. For example, I did a calculation, and we think that maybe in its heyday, about 1400 AD, before the Gangetic Plain of India was settled by agriculturalists, there may have been as many as 500,000 rhinos. That's a lot of rhinos. We also know that the black rhino in Africa, before 1900, there might have been a million black rhinos. So these large herbivores that can eat really tough vegetation, they probably were fairly common, relatively speaking. You know, not as common as grasshoppers, you know, per unit area out in these grasslands, but they were, for a big mammal, if you add up the amount of weight that they occupy or they contribute to in the overall composition of that grassland, they weighed a lot more than the grasshoppers. So it depends on how you look at it. But there's no question that human activities are making these certain species much more threatened. And the rhinos are a great example. For example, for all rhinos, the price of rhino horn has skyrocketed from $30,000 a kilogram in the last year and a half to over $100,000 a kilogram. So powdered rhino horn is worth more than gold. And that's a tragedy because it's fueling a tremendous a slaughter of rhinos in South Africa that's spreading to other countries. In last year alone, we lost 688 rhinos to poachers, and this year it's likely to probably crest over 800 based on the amount of rhinos being poached each month. So this is a global crisis, and we stand a risk of losing these magnificent creatures that are the product of millions of years of evolution.
So maybe give me some interesting rhino facts, because this chapter was, in my opinion, the best. Lots of things I did not know about rhinos.
Well, everybody loves rhinos. At least I hope everybody does. Well, one of the things that actually inspired me to write the book in some ways, and in fact, you could say that my inspiration was because I spent so much time putting my hands in rhino dung, but that wasn't far from the truth. When I started my study on rhinos back in the 80s on a grant from the Smithsonian Institution of the National Zoo, I was sitting on my elephant, and I was ready to compose, you know, a perfect picture on an elephant. In the foreground, a greater one-horned rhinoceros female and her calf, and in the background, the Himalayas, the mountains of Dalagiri and Annapurna, 26,000 feet, only about 60 miles away. And then when I was framing the picture, I noticed this clump of trees that were somewhat unsightly and spoiling my perfect composition. And so I asked my elephant driver, what are those trees doing? They're growing in these clumps. And he said, oh, that's the work of gyna, which is the Nepali word for rhino. Those are old rhino latrines. So rhinos go back to the same place over and over again to defecate. We see the same behavior in antelope in Africa. A lot of carnivores do the same thing, except that coming out of these latrines was, I found lots and lots of seeds of a species called, we eventually called the rhino apple. It was a tree that produced a fruit that was large, hard, and green upon ripening, that was not eaten by bats, birds, or monkeys, but fell to the ground. They were devoured by rhinos. The rhinos ingested them, passed them out, defecated them into their latrines, and then they germinated, and when it was in the sunshine, you'd get these copses of seedlings and then saplings and then trees growing up in the grasslands. And I realized that even though they occur at relatively low densities and the population of rhinos in this national park was far below the level that it could ultimately hold, that even when rhinos are at low numbers, they can have dramatic effects as landscape architects, because I calculated that in a very short time, the rhinos could convert their beloved wild sugarcane grasslands into rhino apple woodlands and then forests in a matter of decades if it weren't for the counteracting factors of the monsoon floods that washed away latrines or fires that burned through them and killed the seedlings. They would convert their own habitat to something completely different. And so that's what got me started, that thinking that, you know, that there's a disproportionate effect going on here, that some really rare species, even at low population numbers, can shape the world.
It's interesting. They're very different from other large herbivores in terms of the range that they require, right?
That's right. Is we typically think of, you know, elephants move over large areas, but this particular rhino has extremely small home ranges, maybe sometimes just a square kilometer or two, it's because their food is so abundant, easily available, and so nutritious and digestible, they don't have to move very far. And there's another interesting fact about rhinos, is that this species produces 54 pounds of dung in a single defecation. Now, I know that because I used to get off the elephant and weigh them. We'd have our rhinos habituated to the presence of elephants, and we could get very close to them as long as we were on elephant back. And we would weigh their defecations because I wanted to know how much dung they produced into their latrines, but also how much they ingested and their overall eating ecology, so to speak. And that sort of shocked me. It's like 54 pounds. That's amazing. And then it got me thinking, you know, the largest land mammal on Earth was not an elephant. It was the giant giraffe rhinoceros that was 20 feet long and as tall as a double-decker bus and lived in roughly the same habitat. It's at the base of the Himalayas. You can imagine, you know, a creature that size, how much dung it produced in a single defecation. It might have been, I don't know, 200 pounds, 300 pounds. But it gives you the impression that these giant mammals, what an effect they had on the landscape.
Well, and, you know, getting back to rarity, you say that the relationship between dominance among males and breeding success in rhinos is pretty much vital to understanding both rarity theory and conservation. Do tell.
You know, one of the concerns that we have with these long-lived mammals like rhinos is that, or any other species, where, particularly in mammals, where one male breeds a number of females, and if that male lives a long time, then it can monopolize all of the females and do all the breeding. And if you have small populations that are essentially like zoos, where you don't have animals moving in and out, then you worry about things like inbreeding. And that was a concern of mine when I started my study, but what I found out, lo and behold, was that in the course of only 5 years, I saw 7 different males become the dominant male in the area where I did intensive work and was able to identify all the individual rhinos by their horns and ears and cuts and scrapes. The line between courtship and combat is very thin in this species. They're quite aggressive, and so they fight a lot, and they leave marks on each other, and so you can tell them apart really easily. And I found that these rhinos had a tremendous amount of very dynamic population, and the longest that a single male was ever dominant was a year and a half, and sometimes as short as only 1 month. And so you think about it. Here's an animal that lives a long time. It takes a long time to reach sexual maturity, and only has a month, perhaps, or 2 months as the top male in an area. So for that reason, they're very violent, because their desire to get in there and breed the females, they have a very short window.
Your last chapter on Bhutan, you say that that's the one place in the world that you think is doing conservation the way that it should be done. What's going on there?
I'd expand that a little bit to include not just Bhutan, but also the nearby country of Nepal and the country of Namibia in the southwestern part of Africa. And what's really interesting about those three countries right off the bat is they're among the poorest countries on Earth. And it's counter to the argument that a lot of people in conservation and development give, that conservation is a luxury, that only when countries reach a certain standard of living can they really afford to consider engaging in national conservation programs. And the fact that three of the poorest countries on Earth have probably the three most effective programs anywhere, I think destroys that myth. In many cases, it's because of a cultural affinity for the wildlife and for wilderness and wildlands. In some cases, it's a religious attachment combined with that, like in Bhutan and Nepal, which are both Hindu, and in Bhutan is a Buddhist country. And I think Bhutan takes that to the highest level, because there, it's written into the constitution that 60% of the country has to remain under forest cover, and that the national parks and the corridors that connect them are part of the Constitution. You know, it's almost as if you could imagine that the Founding Fathers commissioned Lewis and Clark to go through the United States at the time and identify areas to set aside as national parks, and then we wrote those into the Constitution. That's what Bhutan has done. Namibia has done something equally extraordinary, is by forming these communal conservancies. A country the size of California and Oregon, in a few years, will probably have half of its land area under some form of conservation, mostly under communal conservancies managed by local tribes, and then the rest national parks. So that's an amazing example. So I think that there are countries out there that are doing a wonderful job of conserving their rarities, and in the case of Bhutan and Nepal and Namibia, even celebrating them.
Now, is what they're doing scalable, perchance?
To other countries? I think it is. I think that in the case of Namibia, Namibia and Nepal share a common theme of, when you give ownership, in the case of Nepal, the land, the forest, to communities to manage, they often do a better job than the government does of managing those forests for wildlife and conservation and their own needs. And in the case of Namibia, the government decided to give ownership of the wildlife, not the land itself, but the wildlife on it, to communities. And they've done a marvelous job of restoring species that are declining elsewhere. So in Namibia, you still see thriving populations of black rhinos. You see desert lions and desert elephants and desert giraffes all thriving and coming back. across most of sub-Saharan Africa, lions and leopards and cheetahs are disappearing rapidly. They're thriving in Namibia. So they're clearly doing something right by giving ownership to communities to protect these wildlife. And what they've done is invest in high-end ecotourism through joint ventures with companies in Africa. And these expensive resorts that have opened up in these conservancies hire the local people. They bring in revenue. The revenue gets plowed back to the communities. It's a positive feedback loop. It's a win-win situation. And so everybody benefits, the wildlife and the people.
Eric, wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can find Eric Dinnerstein and his book, The Kingdom of Rarities, at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back with more after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the ways that science and medicine impact specific communities. We'll speak to biologist and science educator Danielle N. Lee about using social media, informal experiments, and entertainment culture to share science with underserved groups. Microbiologist and public health researcher Rebecca Creston explains why and how some diseases target specific groups. And Dr. Joe Henrich, Canada Research Chair in Culture, Cognition, and Coevolution at the University of British Columbia, joins us to discuss his research showing how social science is drawing conclusions from a population of outliers in the Western world. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
My next guest is Stuart Pym, the Doris Duke Chair of Conservation Ecology at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. Stuart studies present-day extinctions and what can be done to prevent them. He wrote the acclaimed assessment of the human impact to the planet, The World According to Pym. A scientist audits the Earth in 2001, and he also directs Saving Species, a nonprofit that uses funds for carbon emissions offsets to fund local conservation groups. Good to have you here, Stuart.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
So in the last interview, we discussed rare species, and we've spoken about how we can help animal populations that are considered endangered in past episodes many, many times. But whenever we've talked about the possibility of bringing an extinct species back to life, we've always done it in a very, or at least a fairly positive way. So you are here to make the argument against de-extinction. So first off, de-extinction refers to resurrecting single charismatic species, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so maybe give us a quick overview of why exactly you're opposed to that, and then we can dig into it.
Supposing that I had in my back pocket, in my laboratory, two iconic species in Canada, the polar bear and the spotted owl. And supposing those two species were extinct in the wild, or about to become extinct in the wild, would it be helpful to have those species, you know, in a test tube? And the answer is no, and worse than no. The first part of that is that to resurrect those species would be a tiny, tiny problem within the much larger environmental issues that the extinctions of those two species would have caused. If we lose polar bears from Canada, it's because we have destroyed the Arctic. And there are lots and lots of other things living in the Arctic. If we lose spotted owls, it's because we have destroyed the old growth forests of the Pacific Northwest. With the spotted owls go marbled murrelets and a whole host of other species, 300 other species that depend on those old growth forests. So having one or two species in a test tube is going to be, at very best, very, very tiny part of the problem. The reason, then, is that having species like this is only a tiny piece of the solution. What makes it bad is if we had destroyed the Arctic, if we destroyed the Pacific Northwest, we would have created massive environmental problems. We would have created massive cultural problems. We would have massively harmed your First Nations who live in the Arctic and live in the Western forests. And It's that kind of issue that worries me. It's the idea that, you know, if we could resurrect the polar bear, it would be okay to destroy the Arctic. It wouldn't be. There are many, many good reasons why we need to be worried about global warming and the damage that that's going to do to species, to ecosystems, to peoples, indigenous peoples, First Nations. So having this technology is at best almost irrelevant, and at worst an excuse for people to do environmental harm, thinking that they can make up for their mess later.
Okay, so basically your opposition falls into two categories. One is sort of ecosystem related, and the other one is definitely political. So
exactly so.
All right. So let's start with the ecosystem. So one of the things that I've heard you say is, if we did bring a species back to life that has been long extinct, where exactly would we put them? And that is a very good question.
Exactly so. If you drive polar bears to extinction, where are you going to put them? You've driven polar bears to extinction because you've damaged the Arctic, you've destroyed the Arctic. And having polar bears, you know, in a test tube isn't going to solve that problem. And indeed, every one of the potential de-extinction efforts raises the same question. Bringing the passenger pigeon back to the eastern United States. You know, the eastern United States does not look like it did 200 years ago. We have massively changed the forests. So if you bring it back, is it just going to live in a zoo? You can go down the list. Species we have driven to extinction, we have usually driven them to extinction because we destroyed their homes. And unless you bring those homes, those ecosystems back, having the species in the test tube is not going to do you any good. You know, there's a wonderful scene in Jurassic Park where the botanist sees a tree that she says has been extinct for tens of millions of years, and then lo and behold, a brontosaurus comes up and starts nibbling its leaves. Well, the movie tells you how to recreate the brontosaurus, but not how to recreate the tree and grow it to be, you know, 100 foot tall, and moreover grow hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of trees of probably dozens of different species. I mean, species fit together in an ecosystem, and everything has to be right if you're going to bring a species back.
Well, would that only apply to species that were sort of long extinct? What about the more recently extinct? Wouldn't the environment be similar to what it was?
You know, one of the species that people are considering is the Pyrenean ibex, a
right.
goat that lived in the Pyrenees. And the reason it went extinct is it was hunted. And so I have quipped very unkindly that, you know, creating these goats in the laboratory, you'd have the most expensive cabrito that the world has ever known. Somebody would be having nice roast goat, except it will be, you know, a very, very expensive engineered roast goat. Unless you can prevent the causes of the species going extinct in the first place, it's not going to make any difference.
Well, what about the animals who have been extinct longer? What effect might reintroducing them have on the ecosystem?
Well, I mean, the positive spin on this is that, you know, we could recreate environments that we have lost, we could restore them, and all of that is, you know, all of that is superficially a great thing. If you could bring a species back, that would enable you to recreate the historic environment, then that could be very exciting. But again, you have to begin to think of where you're going to put them. There are many people, for example, who like the idea of bringing rhinos and elephants back into North America. We used to have them, or we used to have their ecological equivalents before they were wiped out by humans 10,000 years ago. But again, you know, if you're going to start releasing rhinos into Kansas, you have to ask what the people of Kansas would think about that.
Okay, well, let's talk about the political aspects of this. I guess let's start with some examples of what you think the political ramifications could be, because you've discussed a number of them.
Yes, and the example that I think is the best of all involves the spotted owl. The spotted owl was a major environmental battle south of the border. And it came down to just how much old growth forest we should preserve. And to the extent that I understand things in Canada, it was pretty much the same argument there. I mean, do we keep on logging Vancouver Island until there's almost no forest left, or do we leave forest, and if so, how much? And because the spotted owl was a US federally listed endangered species, the argument came down to, well, how much habitat are we going to leave? And there was a strong argument made by the forest products industry that we should leave almost no habitat, because, you know, if the spotted owl did indeed go extinct, we could always reintroduce it from captive populations. So in other words, they wanted to log almost everything and leave very small patches of forest behind, with the insurance policy that we could put the species back if things went wrong. So the very notion that you have the potential to do that, not in this case with fancy DNA techniques, but captive bred populations, allows people who want to destroy the environment an argument to do so. That, I think, is what is so extraordinarily dangerous. Of course, we like old growth forests. I've hiked in old growth forests in Canada. They're wonderful, special places, and they have spotted owls, and they have a lot of other things too. And many of us appreciate those forests for a diversity of species. Keeping spotted owls alive in the test tube doesn't solve that problem. In fact, it exacerbates it, because it plays into the hands of people who want to damage the environment.
Well, you've also written in National Geographic that de-extinction would affect research priorities.
I worry about that too. If you look at how research is organized in many universities, there are universities that have made extraordinary commitments to environmental studies. University of British Columbia in Vancouver is one of them. But Canada has a lot of outstanding schools of the environment. But it's also obvious that many schools across the United States made choices which reflected pure economic realities. Realities that it was easier to get funded for molecular biology than for environmental biology. One university in the US, in the Northeast, that has aspirations to be the most important university, on Earth, does not have a school of the environment. Why? Because it chose to do away with environmental sciences by and large and put its emphasis on molecular biology. Now, those kinds of turf battles within universities are well known, and they're pretty nasty. And I've done well in my career because I've won those battles locally. The fact remains that other colleagues haven't been so lucky. So, if somebody says, we have this magic science with professors in white lab coats and fancy gizmos, it totally distracts from the reality of what conservation is all about. Conservation is mostly about engaging different peoples. Many of the issues in Canada involve engaging First Nations, but engaging people who live in the very special parts of the world and finding alternative futures for them that do not involve destroying their environments, but involve them living in those environments in sustainable ways. And I think this sort of high-tech white lab coat gizmos, fancy machines, is an awful distraction from tackling those issues. I mean, globally, the places that I work, Africa, Madagascar, South America, I'm working with people who are among the poorest people on Earth. And if we can save their environments, it's because we can work with them, engage with them, help them in a way that benefits them benefits the environments where they live and simultaneously preserves the biodiversity that occurs there. So I think this sort of perversion of conservation into something high-tech is deeply troubling ethically. You're not reaching out to the people who are harmed by our environmental changes, who are harmed by the ways in which our world is changing.
Well, isn't there some, I guess, inherent value to bringing extinct species back? Just something intrinsically wonderful about
them. Yes, of course. I mean, would I love to see a passenger pigeon? Yes. Would I love to see a great auk, hopping around the rocky islets of Newfoundland and Labrador? Of course. Having said that, you then have to say, well, what's it going to cost? What's it going to involve? What are the next steps? And the next steps are to be distracted from dealing with the very real issues that we face, from having resources devoted to things that at best are only going to make a tiny difference, to ignoring, perhaps in a very malicious and malevolent way, the very real environmental issues that we have to address in the world.
Well, are there any situations at all where you would agree that de-extinction is a good idea?
I have yet to see one that gives me any enthusiasm whatsoever. I could believe that they may be out there, but, I'm waiting for the example, and the ones that have come up have just not been very compelling.
So what kind of conditions would cause you to change your mind about that then? Like, what would have to change?
It would have to be part of, an essential part of restoring ecosystems that have been damaged, and where the only way of getting those ecosystems back is to bring the species back into existence. Now, there is an extraordinary place in the Netherlands. It's 5 meters below sea level. It's one of these areas that have been reclaimed. And in this area, the people managing this protected area have brought back horses and cattle and deer and a variety of other species. Now, the cattle are not quite the wild cattle, and the horses are not quite the wild horses, but they're the nearest thing that we can get using, what managed to survive. And in that, they have created a landscape that is probably pretty close to what Europe was in, say, 1500. It's an extraordinary place. I will get this completely wrong because my Dutch is non-existent, but it's something like Hoogstraten-Plassen. It's a place just outside of Amsterdam where they have recreated almost a sort of a Pleistocene world. Now, I'm impressed with that because of the restoration that it involves, the fact that they brought a lot of these species back, not quite the right species, but the nearest thing that we have at the moment. And I do appreciate that. I think it's a very interesting example. But it's done on a scale that thinks of this in terms of ecosystem restoration. It's as if, 200 years from now, people say, okay, we'd like to recreate Arctic ecosystems because we melted the original ones. So they set aside, a huge area of northern Quebec as a recreated Arctic park. I can imagine things like that happening, but that would still be a measure of our failure to protect the ecosystems that we have.
Stuart, thanks very much for being here.
Absolutely my pleasure.
And you can find a link to Stuart Pym on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You might also like to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, if you're into that kind of thing, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, leave a review, or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.